The scripture reading this evening will be from Matthew 5, verses 38 to 42. Matthew 5, verses 38 to 42. And I'll be reading from the New King James Version. Again, that's Matthew 5, verses 38 to 42. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept. Who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, and he said to them, Why do you make this commotion and weep? Your child is not dead, but sleeping. Then they ridiculed him. But when he put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him. And entered where the child was laying. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha Kumi, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, arise. Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age, and they were overcome with great amazement.
Good evening. Tonight we're going to be continuing our study of the Sermon on the Mount. We have been periodically studying through the teaching of Jesus here, learning some of the challenging things that Jesus is presenting and trying to understand what it is that Jesus is teaching rather than some of the ways that it has been abused. We're in the second half of Matthew chapter 5. We find these, you have heard, but I say to you, statements. And Jesus has already said in verse 17, he did not come to abolish the law and prophets, but to fulfill. So he's not trying to diminish or undermine the law, but rather try to get to the heart of what those laws were really trying to teach us. Because when God gives us instructions, it's not just busy work. It's not just things to see how faithful we might be, how far we might go in being faithful. He's trying to teach us something about being more like him. And I think when we view it from that perspective, then it helps us to understand what it is that God really has in mind with those instructions. So to begin, in verse 38 of Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Now, as you read that, you naturally will have certain ideas come to your mind, ideas that you think are covered by what Jesus is saying. If somebody punches me, then I punch them back. If they take my eye, I take their eye. But that's not exactly what Jesus is talking about there. There is a bit of Old Testament context that needs to be understood to really appreciate what Jesus is trying to address here. And so we're going to look at a couple of passages in the Old Testament. There are three passages particularly that express that idea. We'll look at two of them. And the first is found in Exodus 21, beginning in verse 22, where within that context, the law is being given to the Israelites. We've had the Ten Commandments in chapter 20, and then various laws that were to govern them as a people. So Exodus 21 and verse 22, "If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband will set for him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there's any further injury, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, bruise for bruise, and wound for wound." And then if we skip ahead to Leviticus 24 and beginning in verse 19, Leviticus chapter 24 and beginning verse 19 says, "If a man injures his neighbor just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him." Now, a couple of things that we want to note there. This is not describing a personal vengeance. You hurt me, and so I'm going to hurt you. And God's just saying, make sure you keep it even, right? Because our tendency is, you hit me, I'm wanting to hit you back even harder. I'm wanting to come back at you, and I want to get you even worse than you got me. I want to go further in dealing retribution. What these laws are talking about is not a personal retribution. It's not individual retaliation. Rather, it is a civil penalty for the injustice that has been done. When he says there in Leviticus 24, verse 19 and 20, so it shall be done to him, it doesn't have in mind that you just go do back to him what he did to you, but rather the penalty that the law will give is equal retribution for that. We might remember that the law of Moses, especially what we just read there in Exodus 21, has to do with civil laws which governed the nation. And so it was a moral and religious law, but it was also civil law. And so there's some very practical things from a civil standpoint that would help govern them as a nation. But these were the penalties that would be applied by a judicial court, much like when we have a crime or we commit against a penalty against somebody, we might go to a court and have a judge hear. And so we find that's what the law of Moses is trying to do, which of course is what God has given the governments to do. That's the role of the government, is to judge between people and to enforce law. Romans 13 and verse 4, Paul describes the purpose of government when he says it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword in vain, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. That is really the place that this eye for eye and tooth for tooth has in Leviticus and Exodus and in the day that Jesus is speaking. It is a penalty that the government is to execute, or the judges are to execute against the evildoer, or the one who has done the wrong. We can find a very similar point in 1 Peter 2, verses 13 and 14, where we are subject for the sake of the Lord to every human institution, whether to a king as to one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do evil. And so we need to remember, as we're considering this concept of eye for eye, tooth for tooth, that God gave the punishment role to the governing authorities. And so, even when the government fails to take matters into their hands, or they fail to fulfill their responsibility, that doesn't give us the right to then take matters into our own hands. Because the government often does fail in bringing justice, and for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's just the nature of our system, because we're innocent and proven until proven guilty, or at least we should be. Then if there's not enough evidence, then sometimes guilty people can go free, and that's not justice. It's just the limited scope of how we can practice justice. But even then, it's not our right to go then and take matters into our own hands and execute justice for ourselves. We'll talk about that in just a second here. But there's a couple ideas we want to remember concerning these laws before we get there. It was intended for the punishment to fit the crime rather than being too severe. If you step on my toe, then I don't get the opportunity to then break your arm. Or if you knock my tooth out, I don't get the opportunity to then, break all your teeth, right? And so it's the punishment fits the crime. If I injure you so much that you lose your eye, then my eye is taken as retribution. It's equal. It's one to one. And so it's a just punishment that would be suitable for the offense that was taken. And it also should prevent vigilante justice and emotional responses when people were to take matters into their own hands. It's not intended for us to be able to deal out justice in the way that we see fit. God has already given a a penalty for that, or a standard of justice that is to be executed there. And it's also intended to deter the criminal or sinful behavior. Because if I injure somebody and that exact retribution is dealt back to me, then I don't want to go be punching certain people, right? I don't want to go be hurting other people because I don't want that dealt back to me. You maybe see somebody who is acting all tough and then he punches somebody and then they're trying to punch him back and then he starts cowering back. Well, if you didn't want him to punch you back, then quit punching him in the first place, right? And so it's intended to deter that kind of behavior, knowing that there is a just consequence that results from such behavior. And so Jesus is not, when coming back to Matthew 5, where Jesus brings this up, he's not opposing that concept, because that's what the law said, and he's not trying to abolish the law. But rather, what he's trying to deal with is the way, stop me if you've heard this before, the way the Pharisees have abused it. Because they always seem to abuse all these laws that God has given. It seems they took the idea and they've applied it to themselves. They use it to justify their own personal vengeance. I'm going to get back at him in the way that he injured or harmed me. But we find throughout the New Testament, in Romans 12, for instance, that it is never appropriate for us to take our own vengeance. Romans 12, and beginning in verse 17, says, "Never paying back evil for evil to anyone, respecting what is good in the sight of all men, if possible, so far as it depends on you, being at peace with all men, never taking your own revenge, beloved, instead leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord." Now, you might read, particularly in the Psalms, what they call these imprecatory Psalms, which what that basically is referring to is a curse that's being called upon someone else. And that's what these Psalms are doing, is calling upon God essentially to smite people, or God to crush people. And we kind of read that and think that that's very harsh language, and it is. But the reality is, what they're doing in that is calling upon God to take his vengeance rather than taking it into their own hands. God, take your vengeance against them. Execute justice for the wrongdoing that they are guilty of. And so we find Paul encourages us to leave that to God. That is God's place to execute justice. And the reality is, as we kind of alluded to already, we're not always going to be able to perfectly execute justice because of our finite understanding and a myriad of different reasonings. We're not always going to be able to execute justice, but God will, and he will always do it perfectly. And so we leave it in his hands in order to render justice when it is due. We also find in Leviticus 19 and verse 18 that this same concept was also spoken in the law. And so the law does say, Leviticus 24, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, burn for burn. But Leviticus 19 and verse 18, we already saw there, "You shall not take vengeance, and you shall not keep your anger against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh." So right there, God is saying, don't take vengeance, and so that should color how we interpret chapter 24 with the eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And so God does not want us taking vengeance for ourselves. And so I think there's a number of reasons there, because sometimes we get too emotional when we are wronged, and therefore we're not able to properly or rationally handle a given situation. We've all been there, right? And yet, God knows how to perfectly execute justice, and so we leave room for him to do so. And we also find in Proverbs 20 and verse 22 another instruction very similar to that, where we are called upon to leave room for God to take justice, or take vengeance. "Do not say, I will repay evil. Hope in Yahweh, and he will save you. And so, we are not to take our own vengeance, but this is describing a judicial justice where the penalty that has been given by a judge or by a magistrate of some kind against the wrongdoing that has been done. And so Jesus goes on, if we back up to Matthew 5 and verse 39, Jesus says, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And then verse 39, I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. It's not to say that we want to let sin go unchecked or unaddressed. Paul is going to use this same word for the action that he took in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 11 against the hypocrisy of Peter. He withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. And so he's not saying that just don't ever say anything against an evil person. You know, just let them go. Don't say anything. Don't stand up against them. Don't stand up for yourself or anything like that. That's not the point. But again, dealing with personal vengeance, don't seek to take vengeance against those who have wronged you. And so, we're going to move on to talk about that turning the other cheek here. But before we do, when we consider the eye for eye and the taking of vengeance, we need to make sure that in all that we do, we're acting like a child of God, like a Christian should. And so when I'm wronged, I need to act like a child of God should, like God has called us to act, and not allow the world to influence me and act in a manner that is ungodly. And so this is not our personal vengeance, leaving room for the joy in getting slapped around, like Jesus seems to suggest here. Whoever slaps you on the cheek, turn to him the other also. Now, when you consider the wording that Jesus uses here, I think most people tend to be right-handed. And so if I'm facing somebody face-to-face and I go to slap them, usually that's going to come across and hit them on their left cheek. But Jesus is talking about the right cheek. And so it's suggested that maybe what Jesus has in mind is not so much just somebody hitting you, but rather a backhanded slap, which in this culture especially would be considered a person or an insult. It would be considered a rather insult to somebody to backhand them in that manner. So consider that Jesus is not talking about refraining from defending ourselves. So if somebody hits us or somebody attacks us, that we have no right of defending ourselves, but rather don't return insults for insults when one insults us. If somebody is going to insult us, don't start returning back and forth with them. You just turn the other cheek and you just allow those insults to roll right off. Now, that's easier said than done, but I think that that's part of what Jesus has in mind when he says that. When someone acts ungodly toward us, we should not respond in kind. And I know that sounds very obvious, but it's very difficult in practice to do that. And that's why we find many instructions in the New Testament that call us to that higher standard. So Ephesians 4 at beginning of verse 29, which, by the way, the context beginning at verse 17 calls upon us to no longer walk as the Gentiles walk, but walk according to the new man who has been renewed in the spirit of our minds and has been in the likeness of God, created in righteousness and holiness. And so he says in verse 29, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for building up what is needed so that it will give grace to those who hear. If somebody insults you, do you think that it's wholesome for you to insult them in return? Probably not, right? And so that would probably fit in this unwholesome word that Paul says, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth. We go on in verse 31, he goes on to say, let all bitterness and anger and wrath and shouting and slander be put away from you with all malice. That certainly sounds like the kind of attitudes that are behind returning of insults. if I'm acting with kindness, as he says in verse 32, kind to one another, tenderhearted, graciously forgiving each other. If I'm kind and tenderhearted and gracious and forgiving, how's that return of the insult going to work out? It's not, right? That's the point that Paul is making here. We don't allow the bitterness. We don't allow the anger or the wrath or the shouting or the slander to overtake us. We put those away from us. Instead, we put on godly characteristics, that is kindness and tenderheartedness and gracious forgiveness. That idea of kind to one another, I would suggest that kindness should be underlying everything that we do. In all that you do, be kind. Now, how much better off would the world be if everybody did that? If everybody was kind? Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, graciously forgiving one another. Now, I don't believe that Jesus is saying that it's wrong to defend ourselves. I think this is, again, referring to more of an insult type situation rather than attack. And so I don't think it would fit into a typical type of self-defense situation. But then, again, turning the other cheek does not imply that we should take insult after insult. Like, I don't think what Jesus is saying is we get slapped and we say, "Give me another." And we just stand there and just get slapped back and forth all day long. It's possible, it could be the idea of offering a gesture of love. If one insults you, there may be a problem behind it and you may want to help resolve it. A way to illustrate that, a book that I read a while back, there was a lawyer, he's sitting along with a client and he's trying to, I think it was a deposition, I can't remember exactly the situation, but he's interviewing this guy, and the guy is very short. I mean, he basically acts as if he wants to be anywhere else but in the room with this lawyer. And eventually he says, "You know, lawyers are the worst thing that ever happened to this country." And of course, the lawyer's sitting right across the table, and he's getting angry, and he just kind of breathes for a minute, and then instead of saying, "Well, you know what," he stops and asks, "Well, how's your week been?" And he gets him to talking and telling about what's going on in his life. And he comes to recognize that this guy has been dealing with his mother who's dying and trying to get her estate in order. And there's been lawyers that have come in and have been running crazy over all this issue. And he's just got a very bad taste in his mouth. And by the end of this conversation, this man is laughing and smiling and very friendly towards this lawyer that he was very angry with from the beginning. Now, what if he would have returned insult for insult? Do you think he would have got there? Maybe that's what Jesus means when he says turning the other cheek. Not so much that it's, "Oh, well, hit me again," but rather, what's causing that? What's going on in your life that's causing you to react in that way? Can I help you? Is there a way that I can encourage you? It could also be the idea of simply walking away instead of returning insult for insult. I'm just going to leave. And I'm not going to sit here and allow myself to be berated and on top of that, allow my temper to rise to the point that I'm going to return in a way that is unkind or ungodly. And so I think when we kind of think about turning the other cheek in that manner, it's not just sitting there and being slapped around all day long or just sit there and take insult after insult. There's those things like the roasting of certain people and they just sit there and insult people. I don't see the purpose of that. I don't think that it's not, Jesus is not saying you just sit there and let people roast you. But rather, turn the other cheek or try to find a better way to resolve it. And so, if we back up to Matthew 5, Jesus continues on. He talks about returning the other, or turning the other cheek. In verse 40, he says, if anyone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your garment also. And whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Now, giving your cloak,
Jesus is not presenting a universal principle against asserting our civil rights. But rather, the kingdom citizen is not out to protect our rights at any point, at any cost. Christians are to be devoid of selfish desires and to be gentle, merciful, and peaceful people. And so there's some context that we find within these
statements that kind of show us that what Jesus has in mind. So the idea of giving somebody your cloak, it may be forced. If somebody forces you and they are required to take, or part of the ruling is that your tunic is to be given, he says, give more. Give more than what you are required. Give more of than what is required of you. That's a principle that maybe ought to govern our lives beyond simply just that area, right? Giving God particularly more of what is required of us. If we find that we have wronged somebody, admit it and do what we can to resolve it. We talked about that in Matthew 5, verses 24 through 26. You cannot worship God and have an be at odds with your brother. You cannot properly come and worship God and you bitter against what your brother said or did against you. And then he says, even if somebody else has something against you, first go and be reconciled to that brother and then come and offer your gift. And so do what you can to resolve any kind of wrong that you may have done. And then on the other side, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 7, I wonder if this principle is not applied enough. Paul is talking about this on the other side. If you are the one that is defrauded, he says, actually then it is already a failure for you that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged and why not rather be defrauded? That goes entirely against our mindsets as human beings, right? They mistreated me, and so I'm going to get back at them. Remember that idea of personal vengeance. What are we trying to seek? Back in Matthew chapter 5, blessed are the peacemakers. And again, it's not just the peaceful, it's the makers of peace. And so in all things, what we're trying to do is make peace. Sometimes that means, especially if I'm dealing with a rather immature brother or sister, that sometimes I need to prefer to be mistreated and not expect that they do exactly what I want them to do to make that right. Sometimes I just need to be willing to be mistreated in order to allow peace and unity to continue. There's a limit there. I mean, sometimes there's sin that's involved and that should be dealt with. But think about what Paul says there. Would you not rather be wronged, or why not rather be defrauded? Chew on that for a while. In all things, we need to act like a Christian, and there's more to life than our things. And I think that's part of what Jesus is getting to in Matthew 5 when he says, give them your garment also. There's more to life than stuff. And so don't make such a great fuss over things. And then he says, whoever forces you to go with him 1 mile, go with him two. Now, under Roman law, a soldier had the authority to compel somebody to carry their personal gear for about a mile. A Roman mile was about 1,000 paces. And they had the authority to force you, to compel you to carry their stuff for a mile. Think about Simon, who is compelled to carry the cross of Jesus. And so there's this obligation or authority that they have to compel you to do something. And what Jesus is saying is, don't just go 1 mile, go two. Go above and beyond what is expected of you and do so without complaining. Can you imagine how most of those soldiers would be treated as they were doing that? You good for nothing. Y'all can't carry your own stuff. How? Oh, man, you're inconveniencing me. I'm sure they heard on plenty of that kind of stuff. But then they compel a Christian. And they reach the end of the line and they say, okay, well, that's as far as I can tell you to go. I'll go one more. That would probably be rather shocking. In James 5 and verse 9, Paul says, do not groan, brothers, against one another so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. He's dealing with the way that we deal with one another. Do not groan against one another. Don't complain about each other. And especially don't go complain about one another to those who are outside. That is a terrible idea and will certainly bring reproach upon the Lord. We find in 1 Peter 4 and verse 9, being hospitable to one another without grumbling. There's certainly something to be said about grumbling and complaining. There's a whole lot of lessons you can find in the Old Testament from Israel about grumbling and complaining and how God feels about that. And so what Jesus is saying here is you go above and beyond what is expected of you and don't complain. Don't grumble when you're compelled to do something. Instead, rather than grumbling, go above what then is compelled of you. And in a time when everybody is so focused on their rights, that I have my rights and don't you dare do anything to infringe upon my rights, we saw that a lot in COVID, right? I don't know about here because I wasn't here for that. But I do know many churches dealt with that. When some people says, I can't worship if you're not going to do this. And somebody said, well, I don't want to do that. And then that's not focusing on my brother. That's focusing on me, myself, and I. And so in a time when we are so, when our culture is so focused on our rights and I have the right to do this, Christians should look to the other person to see how they may be of service to them. We need to give our best in whatever we do, even in going above and beyond what may be expected of us. I think that principle might be found in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, where Paul, in the first two verses there, calls upon Christians to be united together. He says, if there's any encouragement in Christ, if there's any consolation of love, if there's any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, fulfill my joy that you think the same way by maintaining the same love, being united in spirit, thinking on one purpose. He's essentially saying, fulfill my joy by being united together. Be one people. Well, how do you do that? Well, verses 3 and 4 gives us the answer. Doing nothing from selfish ambition or vainglory, but with humility of mind, regarding one another as more important than yourselves. And then, not merely looking out for your own personal interests, but also for the interest of others. It means I need to humble myself first and foremost. That's the first thing he says. With humility of mind, regarding one another as more important than yourselves. And can I say, when Paul is saying that, that doesn't give me the right in a discussion or especially a disagreement to tell my brother or sister that, you know, you're supposed to view me as more important than yourself. You've missed it. You've just missed it. That's not, it is right over your head. When Paul says doing nothing from selfish ambition or vainglory, he's not talking about worrying about what everybody else is doing. He's saying worry about what you're doing. Make sure that you're not being selfish and that you're regarding others as more important than yourselves, whether the other person does or not. That I'm thinking about their best interest, that I'm putting them before myself. And by the way, if everybody does that, then nobody's going to feel left out. And nobody's going to feel less than. And nobody's going to feel like they're just not important or they're not cared about. But when everybody's seeking their own,
there's going to be some people that care for others, and they're going to feel like there's no one looking out for them. And so that's the kind of spirit that we need to have, that's associated with this idea of going beyond what might be expected of us. Think about the well-being of others before your own well-being. And can I suggest, when we think about that, especially think about that in terms of opportunities to lead people to Christ. If I can go above and beyond what may be expected of me, that may provide an opportunity for me to be able to speak to other people about the gospel. I had a conversation with somebody, and they said, I'm not even going to begin to even ask for forgiveness. And my thought is, well, I'm willing to. But from that worldly perspective, it's like, I don't even have a right to ask for forgiveness. But then when we offer it, and when we forgive, then that gives us an opportunity to show where that forgiveness comes from. It comes from the fact that I've been forgiven by God. And so let me help you to experience that forgiveness by God too. And sometimes when we go beyond what might be expected of us, it leads us to opportunities to help others to know God. And then give to him who asks to borrow. Not meaning that just if anybody asks you for any little thing, you have to give it, no matter what. But rather, it likely has a connection to the tendency for some to take advantage of the poor, charging high interest and other such things as that. God calls his people to do good for other people. Galatians 6 and verse 10 says, do good to all, especially those of the household of faith. We find in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17 through 19, command those who are rich in the present age not to be haughty or set their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us all things to enjoy. Command them to do good, to be rich in good works, be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. We need to do good to other people and do good for other people. If you just summarize that, just be good people. Just go about doing good in your life. And that would include the idea of being compassionate to one another. If we see someone has a need, we ought to be willing to help them without expecting anything in return. James 2 talks about what good is it if a faith says, I have faith, but you have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. And to illustrate that principle, he says, what good is it if somebody knocks on your door and asks for something to eat, they're destitute, and you say, well, be warmed and filled, go your way, and you don't give them anything to eat. What does that accomplish? What good are you doing? You're not doing any good for them. And so, we want to be compassionate. And if we see the need, be willing to help, and don't expect that it will be reciprocated in some way. And once again, in all points, we need to act like a Christian in all that we do. And so Jesus tells us to turn the other cheek, to give our tunics if we are sued to take, or give our garments also if our tunic is taken. Go an extra mile if we are compelled to go one, which in our culture we're not going to be compelled to walk a mile carrying a soldier's gear. There may be other areas of application there, or give to him who asks of you. Those are some practical ideas that we find in dealing with others. And consider how much better our society would be as a whole if everyone would abide by these principles. Now, I don't expect that we're going to go out and change the entirety of the culture just by abiding by these principles, but we can change ourselves, and then we can change a little bit of the people around us, make an impact on the people around us, and who knows where that will go. But if we go about acting like we ought to, then that can do a profound amount of good for the cause of Christ. While we can't expect the world to live this way, God has called us to. And so let's be the light, shining in the midst of the darkness, and not allow ourselves to be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. And in all that we do, strive to overcome evil with good by shining the light of Christ to the world around us. And so if there's any way in which we can encourage you or help you in applying some of these principles, we'd be happy to help you to do so. If you need to bring your broken life to the Lord, He's ready to restore you, to receive you, to put you back together. Not just
whole,
put you back together like Him, so that you can reflect His image, His glory to the world around us. And so if you need to obey the gospel, to have your sins washed away, to be raised up into new life, we'd be happy to help you to become a child of God. And if you are a child of God and you need to commit yourself to more faithfulness, we can encourage you in that as well. Whatever spiritual need you have, if you need to, if we can pray with you, if we can encourage you or do anything to help you on this journey, we'd be glad to do so this very night. Our Lord provides us an invitation. Again, the song, like the song says, to bring our broken life to Him so that He can redeem it and restore it and make it whole again. And so if you're in any way subject to that invitation, we'd bid you to come while we stand and sing together.